Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest installment of Borders Blatherings, our podcast where we shine a light on the curious, the shadowy and often very magical history of the Scottish Borderlands. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, good morning. How are you?
I am very well, and we're recording on a beautifully sunny day, which is a bit of a surprise.
Well, that's good, and I will apologise if I sound a bit croaky today. I've got a bit of a sore throat, but I'm sure our listeners will be kind to us.
You do sound a wee bitty croaky.
A little bit croaky.
Let's press on and see how we do. Maybe some magic will be bestowed upon you by good old Merlin, the magician. The magician, indeed.
By the end of it, my throat may be fine.
In thinking back to part one of this podcast, where we talked about the origins and the roots of the Arthurian legend, I think often what popped up was you were referencing Merlin.
Yes.
And with Arthur, we did a bit of a tour of Northern Europe because we were placing him in Glastonbury, Tintagel, the Scottish borders, Wales, and so on.
Yep.
And we decided that we would, in this second part, focus a little bit more on Merlin.
Indeed, yes.
It's self, himself, herself, who knows? I'm really glad that you are the historian.
You're worrying me now.
The reason for that is that the whole Arthurian legend and the origins and the ownership, if you like, and particularly Merlin, it's like some kind of ceramic mosaic. And someone has taken the big vase, smashed it into hundreds of pieces. And many historians have tried to put all this back together.
I like that idea.
They've kind of placed it all over the world. Now, you'll know we have some visitors from France here at the moment. And I was chatting to Norbert about the podcast, selling it to him, basically. And he loaded it onto his phone and he went, you've covered a lot of interesting things. I said, well, next in line is a little installment on Merlin. And in part one, which we had already recorded, I was arguing for the Welsh-English origins of Merlin, and you were arguing for the Scottish borders.
Yes.
And he said, oh, you're wrong.
Oh.
The real legend of Merlin lies in Brittany, in northern France.
Ah, yes.
In the forest of Brocéliande.
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, we have a burial stone. We have Merlin meeting Vivienne, who is a human or a fairy, a temptress, a malevolent soul. Who knows? So, a bit of a puzzle for me as a non-historian.
It is very curious that all the stories we have of Merlin arise round about the 12th century. So you have Geoffrey of Monmouth coming up with the Welsh Merlin that most people think of as Merlin. We have the 12th century French troubadours, and they have a Merlin. And then, of course, we have Bishop Jocelyn up in Glasgow, 12th century, Lylocan, which is another name for Merlin. So, yes, Merlin pops up in various different places. I believe he also pops up, I think it's in Saxony. I think he also wandered around Denmark for a bit, but all of the source material comes around the 12th century. And I think it comes from the fact that at that time, Europe was even more of a little patchwork of nations than it is today. And there were lots of kings who had advisors. And magic, astronomy, astrology, alchemy, all these different things come together. So the Merlin character, probably there was a Merlin for every king. Uh-huh. And two or three people have written down the exploits of the king and the exploits of his advisor, and they have all merged together. As you say, your vase, if you put your vase all back together again and glue it all together again, that's your Merlin. So yeah. I think that's, yes, I can quite understand that they have a Merlin in Brittany. Absolutely.
So the key, in a sense, as the non-historian, and I was very quick to make that distinction between us today, is not type into Google, was Merlin a real person? It's not that. Was he based on historical characters?
Yes.
It's the key question.
Yes.
And what you're saying is that every king had a sage, an advisor.
Yes, he all had
perhaps.
An advisor, you know.
Yeah.
I think that the reason I like the Scottish Merlin, who's called Lilochin, is because, Geoffrey of Monmouth is writing in the 12th century.
Yeah.
He is taking oral stories from the Welsh bards, writing that down to justify the Norman invasion of Britain, or the Norman invasion of England at that time. At the same time, the Bishop of Glasgow, Jocelyn, the Bishop of Glasgow, is writing the life of St. Kentigern, but that was based 500 years previously. And Geoffrey of Monmouth's stories are entirely based on oral stories, whereas Jocelyn was writing the life of St. Kentigern, who was a real person. His other name was St. Mungo. So Jocelyn isn't picking up oral stories of wizards and magical people. He's writing the life of a saint. He's writing the life of the Glasgow saint.
Are we back in, 6th, 7th century here?
Yes, for St. Kentigern, yes. But Jocelyn is writing it at the same time as Geoffrey Monmouth is writing it.
Yeah.
And the Scottish Merlin is known as Lilochin, which is very close to the Welsh name Lychochin, which is the earlier name of Merlin that Geoffrey of Monmouth changed, because Lychochin is not that easy to say. So you've got a Lychochin in Wales and you've got a Lychochin in Scotland, which I think is the same person. It was Geoffrey of Monmouth that changed the name to Merlin. But you have the same story. So you have the king up in Scotland and you have his advisor, Lilochin, and the king is killed in a battle and Lilochin is pulling out his hair and he's terribly stressed. And in the Welsh version, remember, he goes north to Henogluth, the forests in the Scottish borders. In the Scottish version, he goes south from Glasgow. To the borderland forests, and he wanders about, and his sister comes to try and get him back, and his wife comes to try and get him back, and they bring him back. And it's exactly the same story. But the reason I'm saying it is slightly more credible is the fact that Monmouth was taking oral stories to create a myth for the Norman invaders, whereas Jocelyn was just writing the life of a saint. And this is just one bit of the life of St. Kentigern. But he wasn't writing fantasy. He wasn't writing it to justify anything. He was writing an actual life of the saint. Now, obviously, at that time, miracles and these sorts of things would be included in a hagiography of a saint. But I think that there's slightly more substance to what Jocelyn was writing than Geoffrey of Monmouth.
Right.
And also this word Lilochin and Lychochin being so similar in the Welsh. And the same forest is named, the same sister is named, the same wife is named. So I'm putting in my pitch for Merlin actually being Scottish and being called Lilochin. Yeah. But of course, remembering back to some of our earlier podcasts, there was no concept of Scottishness then. Because the Scottish borders was Henogluth, it was part of Wales, there were the Welsh there were the Picts there were the Scots there. So, concepts of Scottish or English or Welsh or French or German or Danish did not exist. So although I'm shouting that Merlin is Scottish, I'm saying that Lilochin was from the north. And remember, we spoke about this before. Leaders tend to be from the south.
Yeah.
Wise men tend to be from the north. So if you're in Wales, your wise man's coming from the north. Henogluth was just the Scottish borders.
Yeah.
Now, when Jocelyn starts talking about or starts writing about Lilochin, he is basing him in Glasgow around St. Kentigern. But Lilochin himself comes from the north. So he's coming from the north of Scotland and then coming down. So they're always from the north. In the German versions, in Saxony, he comes from the north, almost away up in Denmark. In Denmark, he's coming from the north across the sea, possibly what would be Sweden or Finland or Norway.
Yeah.
So these wise men are always northern. These are men that can interpret the northern lights. These are men that can, look at the night sky and read things. And, of course, the further north you go, the clearer the night sky is for these wise men.
Yeah.
So he has, I think your vase idea is a very good idea when you try to put it together.
There are a number of overlaps wherever the story is placed.
Absolutely.
In a sense, there's a woman in northern France, it's Viviane.
Okay.
Who may be fairy, maybe human.
Right.
Maybe malevolent.
Morgan Le Fay, yes.
Is this part of what this narrative that develops, is this part of what I, in my non-historian's naivety, think of as this kind of Celtic arc? Because it's going from Saxony through northern France into Cornwall, into the Welsh-English border, up to Scotland.
You can see that arch. Yes. And you can see the movement of Celts across Europe. So that's where their stories are lying.
Yeah.
And again, what you're seeing, because again, as we said in the first podcast, if only there was an Arthur today, everything would be okay. If only there was a Merlin or a Lylocan today, everything would be okay. And you get a lot of that in Northern Europe because of the movement of peoples. It's interesting, as we've often said, Europe has a north-south divide, not an east-west divide.
Absolutely.
You go to Southern Europe, there's no Arthur, there's no Merlin.
Yeah.
They've got a whole other ballgame going on down there.
Yeah.
But Northern Europe, because it is relatively easy to live in Northern Europe. And apologies to the folk in Finland up right in the north of Finland. I know you have a hard time. But it's relatively easy to live in Northern Europe. We have relatively benign winters. We have soggy summers. Mm-hmm. But, we can grow crops and raise cattle and all the rest of it. And so it's fat land. And so people come in because they want a bit of this. You want to protect your land. You want to have an Arthur and you want to have a Lylocan. Mm-hmm. So you can see why these stories would arise in the first place and why they would be told and retold. Because it's very comforting to think everything's a bit rubbish just now. Everything's not going through. But if we had an Arthur, if we had a Lylocan, if we had a Merlin, it would be better. And you
go
get
back
that
to that,
all the way
that
through.
That line in Ego Dutton when they're talking about this great hero, but he was not Arthur.
He was not Arthur because the whole point of that poem is that they lose the battle.
Yeah.
We didn't have that. Because, if you take that idea of an advisor, if you take it all the way through to, for example, the Reformation, and if you take it past the Reformation into the 17th century, when Charles I fell out with his parliamentarians and the civil wars in Britain kicked off, lots and lots of people were still loyal to the king. They thought he had bad advisors. He didn't have a Merlin. The Protestants thought that the Catholics were whispering in his ear. The king is good. He needs a good Merlin alongside him. And so you'll often get that with Henry VIII. A lot of the stuff that Henry VIII got up to, he got away with it because people said, it's his advisors. It's almost always his advisors that, and if I can bring it up to date with modern politics, what happens when something goes wrong in modern politics? The civil servant loses their job. The advisor is sacked or the advisor leaves. Because we don't want it's terrifying if you blame the king. If you've got an idiot for a king, that's terrifying. Whereas if you've got a bad advisor, you can replace an advisor because the king is of the blood royal or whatever. But if we had an Arthur, if we had a Lylocan, and if we had a Merlin, life would be okay.
Oh, this narrative has legs, Sir Walter Scott places the Lady of the Lake is where? Lake Loch Katrin in the Trossachs. It crops up. So this is, it has legs, this story, very much.
Yes, all over the place. And again, that's because of the use of water and the sword in water. Of course, that's going back to giving votive offerings. This is these stories are pre-Christian.
Yeah.
They've been Christianized, but they're pre-Christian.
Yeah.
Because water is a gateway into the gods. It's a gateway to the other world. And you're putting in metal, which is really precious. So it's a votive offering to the gods to make things right.
Yeah.
And if you look at it, if you look at Morgan Le Fay and some of the allegedly malevolent characters in all of the legends, they do tend to be female, but they're not as malevolent. If you read the originals, they're not as malevolent as we have come to think of them. They're merely A lot of it is where they will say to Merlin, you haven't learned enough. You're too sympathetic to human beings. Look what human beings are doing. They chop down forests. They don't live with nature. You're forgetting your roots. Your roots are supernatural. You are part of the other world of fairies and fays and spirits.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and so a lot of what goes wrong, a lot of the mistakes that Arthur makes, a lot of those mistakes are blamed on Merlin. And so Merlin ends up sort of caught between two worlds. So when he loses his mind and goes to the forest, wherever that forest might be, it's because he's not sure of what he's doing. His sister comes and she's trying to pull him back to the spirit world. His wife comes, she's trying to pull him back to the human world. And he's caught between the two. And where are your roots and what are you doing? And you can read a lot of that into the Merlin myths. And a lot of the things that he does are odd and strange. But are they odd and strange, or is it just because we as humans don't understand the significance of them?
Well, if he's doing it because of love, then I would expect a bit of oddness and strangeness.
Yes.
People do.
Yes. And there's also the fact that, of course, Merlin outlives Arthur. And in some of the early versions, Merlin seems to live almost forever. And again, if you have a different time concept, if you have a different way of thinking about time, you know, when you're little and you can't wait for Christmas because, and you just can't wait and it's three more sleeps and all that, you know, your time when you're 5 years old is completely different from time when you're 50 years old. If you are like Locken and you're going to live for 200, 300 years, whether or not Arthur wins a battle today is not that relevant, possibly. So all of that gets pulled apart. And if you go back to the very early versions written by Jocelyn, written by Geoffrey Monmouth, and go back to the source material, you can see these differences. And then, of course, the later versions are changed. And then, of course, you come into modern times and Disney gets his hands on the story and it is changed again. But the basis of the story of a strong king and a wise advisor and how they interact and the fact that half the time Arthur doesn't listen to Merlin, which is half the problem.
Well, yeah, there you have a modern parallel too. Last night, I was thinking of a title for this. I'm glad you mentioned the idea of him living forever, because I thought a good title might be For Merlin, Wherever He May Be.
Yes. And there are people, I know that there are people in Wales, especially today, who believe that they are Merlin. Now, they're not bonkers. They're not, they just genuinely believe that they are Merlin. Not a reincarnation, that they are Merlin.
Not Gandalf, not, is it Dumbledore?
Oh, yes, you see, and that's just modern versions of Merlin. You know, that is just a modern, especially Gandalf in The Hobbit, because you've got, you know, Frodo, you could say, is the leader of that group because he's the ring bearer. Or, I've forgotten his name, Strider, Aragorn, right, because he's the king, right. But the advisor is Gandalf. It is and Gandalf lives forever. When you think he died, spoiler alert for anybody that hasn't read the book or seen the movies, at one point it is assumed that Gandalf has died, but he hasn't. He has merely transformed into another form. He is the advisor. He advises people. And he himself goes to see another advisor who turns out to be Saruman. Oh dear. Stretching the brain here, who turns out to be an evil advisor. But that's the thing. These are advisors and these go on forever. And Gandalf has lived for forever. The kings come and the kings go, but Gandalf lives forever. The kings come, the kings go. Merlin lives forever.
Excellent, excellent.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
Mary, before we finish this, and because we are Borders Leatherings, and we talk about the Scottish Borders, mm-hmm. can we just end with a little story and fill us in on the details of Gandalf in the Scottish Borders? Which forest was he in, and what is the story that pins him here?
Well, the Geoffrey of Monmouth version is that Arthur loses a battle and Merlin loses his mind because Arthur is dead. And so he comes up to Henoglyth, which is the Old North. Mm-hmm. And that would have been Selkirk Forest. Now, Selkirk Forest.
Gotcha. Yeah. Yeah.
In medieval times, stretched for a huge amount of Scottish borders.
Yeah.
And Merlin wanders here, and he wanders alongside the oaks, because he's looking for the oak, because it is a sacred tree again, pre-Christian, you see?
Yeah.
So he's looking for the... If you look at the version from Bishop Jocelyn of Glasgow, Lilochan, the king, dies in battle. He loses his mind. He goes to the Scottish borders. Uh-huh. He goes to the Selkirk Forest. So it's definitely Selkirk Forest. Mm. He wanders about... We know that he goes to the white... The white and black, the Whitadur and Blackadur rivers, because he's walking along with his staff and an adder comes towards him and he throws his staff at the adder and it splits in two, which is why we have the black and the white adder rivers. Yeah. So we know that he's there. We know that he wanders the hills. He wanders the Eildons, and this is before Michael Scott has allegedly split the Eildons, which is interesting.
Right.
Because the Eildons were one hill that split to three, two big, one little. And they talk about the Eildon Hill for Merlin or Lilochan. So it's interesting that the hill is mentioned as a singular. Now, some people said, well, that's a different hill he's climbed up and we've got plenty in the borders. But it could be that, of course, because this is predating Michael Scott, it was the Eildon Hill before he split it into three.
So before Trimontium and all of that, before this concept of three,
yes,
you have one Eildon Hill.
You have one Eildon Hill, allegedly.
Yeah.
Allegedly, okay. Yeah.
Good, good.
There are some mentions of him going to a camp, a military camp, maybe stretching it a little, that it's the Trimontium camp, the old Roman camp, at Newstead near Melrose.
Yeah.
So there are mentions of that. There are mentions of him at St. Mary's Loch, at the Greymare's Tail, there.
Yeah, yeah.
So he did certainly wander, and it was said that when his wife or his sister came to try and find him, it was difficult because he was wandering and he was howling at the moon and howling with the wolves, and in the winter there were icicles in his beard and he didn't care and he lived up the trees like a squirrel. So there are lots of very evocative, very sort of, you know, illustrative of just how crazy he had gone. You know, he was living up a tree like an animal, not a human being. He had icicles in his beard and he didn't seem to care. Howling at the moon like an animal. But again, if you're Merlin, if you're Lilochan, and if you are a spirit person, if you are from the other world, then all you're doing is going back to nature.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's the humans that don't understand your behaviour. Your behaviour is perfectly understandable to everybody else. So it's quite obvious that he is here, although, to be fair, there are some mentions of him wandering further afield to other forests. Is that him heading off to Brittany? Is that him heading off to Saxony? I don't know.
But in the Scottish borders, both... So his wife comes to
try and get him back.
In the French, Northern French version,
yep.
He encounters, as I mentioned earlier, Vivian.
The Enchantress. The
Fairy Enchantress.
Yes.
Anything to mention about that?
There are mentions of that in Geoffrey of Monmouth, that there was some enchantress in those woods, because the woods themselves are considered to be enchanted or haunted, is maybe a better word. By some sort of fae spirit that may or may not be there. That's not in the Jocelyn version. That I'm aware of. But again, woods and nature is considered to be feminine. It's the you know, the divine female. Nature is
nature
female.
Nature is mother, nature is female.
So whether or not this was just his wife getting upset that she caught him canoodling somebody and that's been written up as something different, I don't know. Yeah, it's one of those, you take your money, you pay your money, you take your choices on that one. But he's certainly very firmly, you know, both mention Henoglith, the Scottish borders, the Selkirk Forest, Greymare's Tale, all of these locations are there and can be seen. And as I say, when it talks about him wandering further afield, it could just be something down into Northumbria, or it could have been across to Brittany, because of course, remember, by this time, he's not just a wise man, he's a wizard. He can do magic.
Yeah.
Remember, Michael Scott would get dishes dancing across from France for him. So if Merlin or Lilochan decided he wanted to go and visit Brittany for a day, I'm quite sure he could have. Yeah. There was no problem with that.
Yeah.
You know, I think what's interesting is that, again, it's the eternal truth that these stories tell us. They're telling us about grief and loss. Often I find in the modern world, if you hear of somebody whose partner has died, we often don't know what to say. We'll rush out and buy a sympathy card because we genuinely don't know what to say. Because we don't want to say, how are you, in case the person bursts into floods and tears and says, well, actually, I'm having an awful time because my partner's just died. We don't know how to deal with that. Whereas in all of the stories of Merlin, it's perfectly acceptable for him to go to the woods and tear his hair out and scream and bawl and shout because his king has died.
Yeah.
And they say that he was in the forest for a long time. Well, if you speak to psychologists, they will say that grief can take up to 2 years to fully process.
Yeah.
So if he's spending 2 years in the woods with nature, trying to console himself for the loss of his leader, his king, that's perfectly understandable. It's showing that you can express your emotion. You're allowed to express your emotion. It's showing you that nature is good. Any psychologist will tell you a walk in nature is actually very good for you psychologically. So there are lots of elements in there. It's also showing that sometimes bad things happen no matter how powerful you are. You might be as powerful as Lilochan or Merlin the magician, but his king still died. Sometimes there are things that happen to you out with your control.
I slightly rail against it. It's quite an American view of closure, as if the lid has to be placed on a box, whereas grief is ongoing. It's an ongoing journey.
You can learn to live with grief. Yeah. You can learn to find to manage your grief.
Yeah.
But if you've lost the love of your life, that's a wound, and that's what that story's telling you.
Yeah.
It's okay to go crazy, but we don't do that. If you walk into the woods and start screaming, somebody will call a doctor on you instead of saying that's just somebody who's having a bad day. They needed to go into the woods and have a bit of a scream. Or you can't always control what happens to you, Arthur dies, but you can choose how you react to that. And so I think that's why those stories are eternal. The nonsense about the stone and the sword and the stone and the love sword there, a lot of those are later additions. To the actual story, especially of Merlin Lilochan, where it is this wise man, this wild man. His wisdom comes from nature. It comes from this other world that he inhabits or he is from. That's where that wisdom is. And again, coming into modern terms, the environmental movement and the number of people that tell you, you know, wisdom of speaking to First Nation people live with nature, Aboriginal peoples in Australia or Canada or America, and these sorts of people who live with nature as opposed to trying to control it because you can't. And look what happens when you try to. So I think there are a lot of eternal truths in the Merlin Lilochan legends.
There are lessons
there for us today.
Yeah. I'm thinking magic mirrors here because the character of Merlin holds up a mirror to our behaviour.
Yes, yes.
Externally and internally, it's working
absolutely.
In both directions
in
a sense. Yeah. And he himself can go through such great grief.
Yes, but also the fact if you look at Arthur and the times that Arthur makes mistakes, there are lessons today for our politicians who would like to learn them, is that almost all of the mistakes Arthur makes is because he ignores Merlin's advice. And Merlin says, I mean, Merlin's not, oh, you're wonderful, you're the greatest king that ever lived. There's an old saying, you don't tell a king what he can do, you tell him what he should do. And Merlin tells him what he should do, and Arthur just toodles off and decides he's going to do something, and then it all goes wrong. And then he goes back to Merlin, and Merlin says, well, I told you. So there are lessons in that. Listen to somebody. And what is slightly comedic, but utterly depressing at the same time, is Arthur repeats the same mistakes. And there's the old saw, you know, if you don't know history, you repeat it. Arthur does the same thing time and time again. And you look at politicians and you think, I think you need to watch an Arthur. You need to watch the Disney Arthur. Anything. Just look. If you repeat the same mistake, you will get the same result. And your advisor will roll their eyes or whatever political advisors do now and say, I told you that wouldn't work. So again, there are lessons there to say, you don't always have to agree with somebody who's giving you advice. But if you're doing the same thing over and over again and it's going wrong, then perhaps it might be an idea to listen to your advisor. And at one point, I think it's in the Geoffrey of Monmouth version where they go up and they capture Merlin and they drag him back to court in chains and sort of stick him in a dungeon. At which point Merlin goes in a huff and refuses to talk to them. I'm thinking, well, does that not to, don't force somebody, you know, Arthur, basically Merlin just sits and goes, well, I'm not talking to you now. I can't give you advice if you chain me up. And you think, again, there's lessons there. If you're trying to force somebody to agree to your position, it doesn't work. You might be forcing them with chains or you might be forcing them with political pressure, but it doesn't work. And Merlin just shakes his head and sits there and eventually they have to take the chains off him. At which point he promptly walks away, back up to Hen Ogleth, and they get very angry. And he said, well, what did you think I was going to do? You chained me up. And of course I'm going back up north where you don't chain me. And there's also the fact that he's getting away from the court. He's getting away from the pressure. How many times do people go on retreats today to get away from the pressure?
Political interference,
Exactly, and away from modern day stresses and strains. So there are lots of stories in the Lilochan and Merlin myths that I think can teach us lessons today.
Mary, thank you very much. I have a feeling that in what will have been a 25-35 minute podcast, we've taken a very slow journey from about the 6th, 7th century up to today.
Absolutely.
And the mirror is still being held up.
If we would but look in it.
If we would just take a wee look.
Indeed.
Mary, thank you very much.
That's great.
Fantastic.
Bye for now.
Bye for now. Bye.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.